Cambridge author Celeste Ng catapulted to celebrity author status with her second book, Little Fires Everywhere. That's now a limited series on Hulu starring Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. And after 6 years of writing, Ng has released her latest novel. It came out October 4th. It's called Our Missing Hearts and takes readers to a dystopian world that feels eerily possible and also close to home. Celeste joined us in the studio to talk about the book, and I asked her how she's feeling just a few days after Our Missing Hearts was released.
I'm feeling all of the feelings right now. I feel really fortunate to actually get to go out and talk to readers about the book, meet them. That's a really special experience. It's also always a little scary to put a book out into the world. You don't know whether it's going to connect with readers. And so the response so far has been really wonderful.
What do you love most about getting to meet your readers?
Well, when you're writing a book, you're kind of by yourself, and you don't know if the things that you're writing about are things that other people will care about. You don't know if the things that you're writing will even be interesting to other people. And so it's really meaningful to get to go out and meet readers and have them say to me, this book explains something to me about my life or my family, or this book made me ask questions. That's maybe the nicest thing that a writer can hear. The sense that what you were writing actually meant something to somebody else, that's a really fantastic thing to hear.
So this new book, Our Missing Hearts, we'll dive into it in a second, but I have to ask you, what are you hearing from readers about it already as you meet them?
A lot of them are saying that it's very moving, especially people who have children or who've been involved in raising children. A lot of them are saying that it's making them think about the world that we live in today and what the parallels are between the world in the book and the world that we're living in and what they can do about it. And that's been a fantastic piece of feedback.
And the two main voices are a 12-year-old boy and his mother, who are separated by many plot lines in the book, but, you know, there is a mother and a child who are the prime voices here. I thought maybe what I would try is to tell you at the simplest level what I think the book is about for our listeners, and then you can tell me if I basically got it.
Okay.
So this is a story at its heart of a family. The son is separated by distance. His mother is in hiding. Because they live in a world in which there's been an economic collapse, and coming out of it, the U.S. has decided that China is the scapegoat, and it takes two steps. One is virulent anti-Chinese sentiment, which turns into a culture of anti-Asian sentiment in the country, and a fascist-like set of policies, including child removal for people who too vociferously disagree with the government. And it takes place, wait for it, basically in Harvard Square for a lot of the story. How'd I do?
Pretty well. I feel like that's a really good summary of the situation in the book. And that's exactly the world that Bird, who's the 12-year-old protagonist of the novel, finds himself in at the very beginning. And part of the book is about him trying to reconnect with his mother, to find his mother and understand why she left him. And that's also the story of him trying to understand the world that he's living in and how it came to be that way, and maybe how he can try and make it better.
So, you know, as I'm reading the book, and I had crashes of thoughts, oh, I want to talk to her about this, and I want to talk to her about that. So the first one is, so you started writing this book in 2016. So much of the hate in the book feels like it resonates with the COVID era, both, you know, the hate crimes and the acts of hate against undifferentiated members of the Asian and Asian American community in Boston, right, during that time. But I wonder, was this a prediction in 2016, or were you stunned when COVID comes along and now so much of what you had already started writing feels like it's playing out in our streets here?
Well, I think that as a Chinese American woman, I think that I've always been aware that this kind of violence was out there. I've seen some of it happen. I think that for most Asian Americans and really most people of color, you know the feeling that at any moment a situation could turn and someone could suddenly look at you and go, you don't belong here. What are you doing here? And so when COVID hit and we started to see all of the increase in attacks on Asian Americans, I wasn't exactly surprised. It was sort of an escalation of something that I think I'd been aware of. What was horrifying to me was seeing out in the open it was. How some of these attacks, many of the attacks, were in the middle of the day. They were on elderly people, often. And most horrifying to me was that sometimes people would just watch them happen. A lot of them got caught on videotape, and bystanders would just sort of walk by. And that was a lot of the feeling that I wanted to explore, especially in the second half of the novel, is what do we do in a situation like that? You know, when can you just walk away and say, well, that's somebody else's problem, and when does it become an us problem?
So, and I'll issue a blanket spoiler alert from this moment forward for listeners in our conversation. There is a moment in the second half of the book when Bird finds himself in New York.
Mm-hmm.
He looks across the street and sees a woman that he thinks might be his mother and very quickly figures out that's not my mom. But his hunger to see her makes him think it's her for a moment. And he's describing her, and she's walking a dog, and out of nowhere, a man bludgeons her, just beats her to the ground, kicks her, and then kills the dog. And nobody does anything. Bird screams, the man looks at him, Bird runs off. Let me tell you why I'm bringing that up. Not only does it resonate with the things that you just said, but here's what I found myself thinking. In Boston, I could imagine people writing that off. Oh, that's New York, right? That's one of those New York stories. She wrote that in New York. I feel like the book is saying that could have been Harvard Square, not New York. And would people have been able to tolerate it here if you had told that story about us?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, one reason that I wanted to set the story in Cambridge, as you said, a lot of it takes place right around Harvard Square, partly because I live here. It's a world that I know. It's a world that I, you know, felt that I could describe. But partly it's also the world has this perception of Boston, Cambridge in particular, Harvard even more so, of being this liberal bubble where nothing bad ever happens. I think we have that impression of ourselves as well. We'd like to think that. But the truth is that racism is everywhere, and this kind of anti-Asian sentiment happens everywhere. And, you know, I've walked in my own neighborhood in Cambridge. I'm, you know, running an errand. I'm walking with my kid home from school. And I've had the experience of people leaning out their windows and just shouting slurs at me. And I think many people are horrified and surprised to hear that. And many other people are like, yeah, that's how it happens. The truth is that we're not better off than anywhere else is.
So in the things that were banging around in my head that I wanted to talk to you about with this book, another was a conversation that I had with Margaret Atwood in 2020. So she had produced the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. It was called The Testaments. And it also takes place in Cambridge in Harvard Square. And I asked her about that choice, and she said something really specific about why she did that that made me think of you.
It would be very unlikely, you would think, but then you look back at Germany and see how quickly, once Hitler had got his hand on the levers of power, how quickly he turned it. So it was a bit of a warning. You think it can't happen here, and then it happens.
And I want to add to that, not to be political, but to underscore that you think and then it does and you think it can't. Interestingly, after the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, she made some statements but also posted a photo of herself holding a mug that said, "I told you so." And is there an "I told you so," given that you started this book in 2016 and it's 2022 now, is there an "I told you so" in this book?
I wouldn't put it as an "I told you so." I think I would put it as, okay, so now you know. What are we going to do about it? Because I don't want to give the impression at all that I was ahead of the curve on any of these things, that I knew better than anybody else did. For me, it's more, this is an experience that I already had. And I think for so many Asians, but also for just people of color generally, if you've had that experience, you know. And if you haven't had it, you don't know. And the real question for me is not, well, why didn't you know before? But now that you do know, what will you do about it?
So that's interesting, because it also feels not only like the question that you're asking the readers, but it feels like the question that the characters are asking themselves.
Yes.
One of the things that happens, I had never felt like I really understood or connected with protest art until I read this book. And there are several guerrilla art installations, ice sculptures and yarn on trees and ping pong balls with messages, all of which are done quietly and then disappear quickly or are erased by law enforcement quickly. And as they happen, they're designed, and this is where we'll come back to, you know, our missing hearts as a thread, that phrase is a thread through them, to help raise awareness that many more children are being taken from their homes and, quote unquote, resettled, right, with more appropriate families. And it raises this awareness. And it feels like the characters, one by one, are confronted with, okay, now you know. So what are you going to do? What was it like to ask yourself in your own imagination, well, what would I do, so that you could write it into the choices the characters then make?
I'm so glad you said that, because that was the question that I was asking myself. And one of my writer friends has a saying. They say, give the problem of your novel to your novel. And what they mean by that is whatever you feel like you're wrestling with in the writing process, a lot of times that's a question that your characters need to answer in the pages of the novel as well. And so when I started writing this novel, I was looking back at periods of history in which free expression and free speech were really being curtailed, in which groups were being discriminated against, in which the government was really authoritarian. And one of the things that struck me was how much I had not known. I had known about some of these things. I had known about Japanese internment, for example, during World War II, when Japanese Americans and, you know, American-born, you know, citizens of Japanese descent were incarcerated in the desert. I had known about that, but I realized that a lot of people had not. And I learned a lot about other things that I was sort of embarrassed to not have known more about. I knew, for example, about the so-called boarding schools, the residential schools that Native American children were sent to, but I hadn't known how horrific they were. And part of that feeling is guilt. And part of that, again, I think is the question you pointed out. What are you going to do about it now that you do know? And I think that's a question we're wrestling with now.
So the U.S. Department of the Interior had a report in May, just to underscore what you just said, that found there were 408 boarding schools for Indigenous children between 1819 and 1969, where children suffered forced cultural assimilation and physical abuse. And so far, they know of more than 500 children who died, to kind of underscore the realities of what you're talking about. All right, so I'm going to ask you now to read a little bit from the story. We've picked a little selection. I'll ask you to read it, and then if there's any context you want to provide around it. But this is Bird.
Sure. This is a little section where Bird, whose birth name is Noah, but he goes by the nickname Bird. He's about to have an experience. At first, it had been just a phrase, like any other. Not long after his mother left, Bird had found a slip of paper on the bus, thin as a dead butterfly's wing, in the gap between seat and wall. One of dozens. His father snatched it from his hand and crumpled it, tossed it to the floor. "Don't pick up garbage, Noah," he said. But Bird had already read the words at the top, "All our missing hearts." A phrase he'd never heard before, but that sprang up elsewhere in the months, then years, after his mother had gone. Graffitied in the bike tunnel, on the wall of the basketball court, on the plywood around a long stalled construction site, "Don't forget our missing hearts."
A line from a poetry book of hers that gets pulled into the movement and eventually drives her into hiding, really to protect him.
Yeah.
And the first part of the book is in Bird's voice. We get into the second part, and now we're in Margaret's voice, his mother. And as a mother, I'm going to get a little emotional here, as a mother of a teenage boy, I thought, oh, no, 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 no. Do not make me go into the head of the mother here and live this through her. Your boy is Bird's age. What did it cost you to put yourself in the mind of the mother?
Yeah, when I started this novel, my son was quite young, and it took me so long to finish the novel, honestly, that he's almost caught up to Bird's age now. It was really difficult because I think, you know, one of the worst things that a parent can imagine is being separated from their child or having to be separated from their child. And writing this book was sort of an exercise in imagining what what would I do? What would I take on? You know, what would have to make it worth it, so to speak, for me to leave my child behind? And that is a really difficult question. I think I would like to think, of course, I would live by my principles. I would stand up for the things that I believe are right. I'd do whatever was necessary. And the calculation gets really complicated and really difficult when your family, the people that you love most, might be put in danger. And that is the question that Margaret, Bird's mother, is asking herself in the second part of the book.
When I had to provide like a one-sentence summary for the story, I said, well, it's about hate, and it's about fascism, and it's about trust in each other. Is that right?
I think that's right, and I'm so glad that you pointed out the trust part. For me, it is about finding trust in community and hope in the face of hate and fear and everything else. It really came out of me asking myself questions during the Trump years and then during the pandemic of, how do I raise a child in this kind of world? How am I supposed to tell him, okay, we're working on this, it's going to get better. How do I hold on to hope in the face of all of this? I think a lot of people have been asking themselves those questions. And so although the book does go into a dark world, for me it is about Bird learning to find hope again and to find connection to his mother, to other people, to the values that his family has been trying to hold on to despite everything.
Has this book changed you writing it? And if so, how?
I think it has. It's cheating a little bit to say that every book changes me, I guess. But this one has made me ask a lot of questions to myself about how you live values versus just how you maybe speak about them, what the difference is between acting on those values and just sort of espousing them. I think we often talk to our children and we tell them how we think they should be. But one thing that I'm learning, especially as my child gets older, is that they watch you as well, right? And a lot of times the moments that you don't think that they're paying attention are the moments that make a huge impression on them. And so it really has made me think a lot about the ways that I show him how I try to live as the kind of person that I'm trying to teach him to be.
So you said the book asks readers, now you know, what do you do about it? What do you want readers to do?
I think I want people to notice, to pay attention, to not be complacent when they see things happening that they know are wrong. That sounds like such an easy thing to do, but it can be really hard. In the moment, you often are startled and you don't know what to do. But having been in situations where I've dealt with harassment or violence on both sides, I know that it makes a difference when people are not bystanders or when bystanders step in. There was a time years ago, I remember, I was on the T and there was a woman wearing hijab and a man started harassing her and just saying all kinds of vile things to her. And it was just the three of us on the train and the conductor. And the conductor was aware of the situation and was getting to the next stop and had called the police. But in the meantime, I didn't know what to do for this woman. And so I just looked at her and I just started talking to her about the weather and looking at the guy and rolling my eyes. And I hope that made a difference to her. I know that when I've been in situations like that and someone has stepped in, it made a huge difference to me to just have someone else say, I see what's happening here. You're not alone. You're not wrong in thinking this is wrong. I see it too. And so if readers, after thinking about this book, have in the back of their mind, oh, I can make a difference. Even just talking to someone, even stepping in a small way can make a difference. I think that would be a good thing. I would be happy with that.
Celeste Ng is the author of three books. Her latest is Our Missing Hearts, and it's out now.